Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase, NA member FDIC, 2024, JP Morgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by comedian and actor Sarah Silverman. Her career began back in 1993 when she was hired at just 22 years old as a writer and performer on SNL. Although she was not long for 30 Rockefeller, Silverman found her way out west, where she quickly made a name for herself as a provocative stand-up in Los Angeles. In between bit roles on programs like Seinfeld, The Larry Sanders Show, or Mr. Show with Bob and David, Silverman continued working on her craft. Then, in 2006, she released her debut special, Jesus is Magic, which, in retrospect, was kind of a precursor to the Sarah Silverman program on Comedy Central. That ran from 2007 to 2010. Over the last decade, Silverman has continued to make really interesting work. She's been the star of indie films like Take This Waltz and I Smile Back. She's written a memoir recently adapted into an off-Broadway musical entitled The Bedwetter. And she's released 4 comedy albums, including her latest for HBO, Sarah Silverman, Someone You Love. That special debuted back in May. If you haven't checked it out yet, it is worth watching. It's currently available to stream on Max. As you're about to hear, there are lots of reasons why I wanted to sit with Sarah, especially in this moment. Beyond the special, she has this new podcast called The Sarah Silverman Podcast. Now, a whole lot of comedians and actors have podcasts these days, but what Sarah does on her show is actually really unique. It's mostly an old school call-in show where folks from around the world send in a voicemail and sometimes ask for advice, sometimes just offer feedback. And no matter the episode, what you find again and again on this show is Sarah connecting to people and offering them a space to be idiosyncratic, funny, flawed, deeply human, and all the things that I think she's really interested in doing in 2023 in these increasingly fractured, anxiety-ridden times. So if you haven't checked out the Sarah Silverman podcast, I recommend you do so. We talk about the show a little bit at the beginning and end of this conversation. before we get going on this Father's Day special, I just want to dedicate this episode to the late Donald Silverman. He was, of course, Sarah's father, who happened to pass away in early May. We talk about that a whole lot in this conversation, but his spirit, his generosity, his wit, his humor, it lives on and reverberates through our guest today, the great Sarah Silverman. Sarah.
Sam.
Welcome.
Oh, it's so nice to be here.
This has been, this has been a long time coming, but I actually don't know if it has, because one of the reasons I never invited you on the show, I'm going to get out in front of it now, is because when I first moved to Los Angeles, I went to one of your parties.
No. Oh, yeah?
You know those ones you used to throw on the roof?
Yeah.
That were so fun. And I remember walking in.
Oh.
I must have been 22 years old, 23 tops. And I went to go get a drink. And above the punch bowl, there was a sign that read, "No, I won't be on your podcast."
No. That's how you're remembering it.
It was something like that, right?
I have a big sign, and I made it myself, and it says, "No podcast solicitations," because the party's really special. I don't go to parties much. I did have this one party every year that I would throw on the roof of my old building where I used to live. And it was perfect. There was no conversation you would want to avoid. It was all people. Everyone who was there would know at least three people and would meet at least three people. Like, it's just
what, that was true.
Yeah. That's my best like description of the party, is it's just like every kind of person, and everyone's vulnerable, but everyone's safe. And you see someone like Diane fucking Keaton, and she's just by herself going up to people like, "Hi, I'm Diane."
Mm-hmm.
It's awesome.
It was a great time.
Yeah.
And now you're here.
Now I'm here.
At long last.
Finally. But, I knew you only through basketball.
Right.
So I was just like this scrappy kid that I love, who's awesome at basketball, and we play basketball. But then I listened to your podcast, and I was like, oh, my God, you're incredible. Get a load of this kid.
Oh, my God. This sounds like my mother. How are you doing?
That sounds loaded. And I'm guessing it might be because both my parents died this month.
It feels a little disingenuous for me to start anywhere else, I think.
Yeah, right.
I can't just be like, "So your new special here."
You know, I think I'm in like a... grief. It comes in waves. It takes its own trajectory. It's none of my business where it goes. This happened with my mother years ago. I was like, it doesn't hit until you're like in line at Gelson's, and then you start sobbing to the person behind you. Yeah, my stepmom, Janice, who's been, in my life since I was 7, got pancreatic cancer over Christmas. I just crazy. And still we just were like, she'll lick it. I mean, this is a woman who played her best golf like this year,
Unbelievable.
But, that one really gets you.
She was a fighter, though.
She was a fighter. And it would have been better if they swapped ailments, because if they did, my dad would not fight it and just go, "I'm just going to go give me palliative care. I lived a long life." But she wanted to fight. And then he had something he probably could have fought. But was just like, "Nah, I want to be with Janice." He had like kidney failure, and we promised him no more hospital. And I talked to his doctor, and his doctor's like, I as a professional, I need to say he should be in the hospital and he should be on dialysis. But as a human, I totally get it and respect it, and probably would do the same thing.
Mm.
So I was happy in these circumstances to be able to go back. I was in the hallway talking to his doctor and then go back into his bedroom and go, "Dad, No more medication. I mean, he was probably on 40 pills a day. This with food, this without food. This, you know, he fucking hated it. And
just completely maddening.
Yeah. So I go, no more medicine. None. You're done. And we're all going to be here with you forever. You know, all four sisters and two nieces and a nephew just kind of hunkered down in their apartment here in Los Angeles. And we were with them for both of them when they passed on. And with my dad, it was like such a celebration that night when we were like, that's it, you know, and we stayed in bed with him and we were laughing and he's singing the worms crawl in, the worms crawl out, the worms play pinochle on your snout. And we're laughing and singing old songs. And, you know, I miss him. And when you miss, you know, obviously I miss him from his more vital days, but I even kind of miss him from these last days where I was like just kissing his face all over and rubbing his silky hair. And it felt good on his head, or like rub his hair and just being very intimate with him, you know, like changing him. Like he'd be like, I shit myself, you know? And then, and it, at first it was really scary. It was like, I had this assumption that he was, would be humiliated or embarrassed. And I go, Dad, are you embarrassed that we're cleaning you up? And, you know, he goes, I don't give a shit. And it became like just a really special. It took like three of us and we'd roll him over on one side and I'd just be holding him and hugging him. And I'd go, you're my best friend. I love you so much. He'd go, I love you. I, you know, whatever. And I didn't want to let go. And then we'd roll him on the other side and Adar, you know, his grandson, my nephew, would gets to hug him and go, I love you. I love you, Zaid, you know, whatever. And then we're wiping him, like, we're cleaning him up in it.
The dream team.
Yeah, the stream team. It's real.
I wasn't going to call it that.
It took a few days, but we really embraced it. It became like getting him clean felt so good, and it felt so good to do for him, you know, and him not being embarrassed by it was just massive. You know, I like my therapist says, we're in skin suits, man, you know, but it really is true. These are like these shells that our selves are in.
Is your therapist Jeff Bridges from The Big Lebowski?
Yeah, my therapist is the dude. He does kind of look like the dude.
You said on a recent episode of your podcast that the thing about death is that it's all right for them because they're gone.
Yeah.
It's just a pain in the ass for the rest of us here that miss them.
Yeah, I take real comfort in that they're fine. We're the ones suffering. And right. I find that's comforting, you know?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that.
I mean, listen, it could be true. It could not be true. It's a survival skill like anything else, like religion or, you know, making fun of yourself before someone else does. It's all the same, but yeah.
And thinking about them, your stepmother and your father, you dedicated this new special to them, right?
And you're like, how could you have known? Well, yeah. I mean, I shot the special exactly 2 months ago today, and it's already out. Like, it really turned over fast. And in doing the post stuff, I knew Janice was, she was in hospice at that. We were, you know, it was hospice at that point. So I knew I wanted to dedicate it to Janice. And then a few days later, I texted my manager, partner, Amy, and I said, yeah, we should probably dedicate it to both of them. I mean, listen, we're a dark family. I mean, my dad was making jokes. I don't know if I mentioned this one, but like, you know, we quadruple checked, like, this is really your choice, Dad, right? You know, hospital. No, I don't want to fucking go to the hospital. I want to be with Janice, whatever. And we wanted to honor that. So about 2 days into it being no turning back, he goes, you know, I changed my mind. I want to live. And we're like, oh, my God, you're such an asshole. It was a split second where we're like, and then we knew he was fucking with us.
I think anyone who watches your new special, it's called Someone You Love, will immediately understand, based on this conversation, where you get your morbid comedy from.
Yeah.
Like, it's very clearly your dad. And even in this new special, my favorite pieces of material, I think, are around the anti-abortion activist and the anti-Semitism. So I'm curious, what was it like to work out this material on tour, performing in states where abortion access is actively being taken away and yeah. anti-Semitism is on the rise?
It was really wild. So many states on the tour are abortions illegal. And it's really not big in the news. I mean, it's really not, it's bizarre. And nothing monumental or massive or like things that are going to be historically huge feel that way in the moment. Mm. Yeah, I've said this before. It's like this life doesn't suddenly go into slow motion, or there's no music telling us how to feel or tell or indicating that this is a major event. These moments happen, and then the next moment, and the next moment, and the next moment, and you're living regular life, and you can't stop any, you know, stop all things and say this is like this huge moment in history.
And yet, in both this special and your podcast, you kind of keep returning to these subjects again and again in a way that you seem pretty undaunted by. Does performing this material, where you can't really disassociate because you're in front of real people whose lives are being changed in the moment, does it relieve the fear and anxiety you feel about this time in America?
Maybe. Yeah, I think there's like maybe some kind of pressure valve in it, you know? I mean, I just think it's like it's somewhere that I have control, like, you know, in comedy. And also, I think when I talk about it, there's a big difference to me between politicians and billionaires who buy those politicians and the disingenuous laws that they pass and policies that take our rights away. I hope they go to the hell I don't believe in. But these protesters outside of abortion clinics, as angry as I get at them, they just believe. You know, like to me, there's a difference between the liars and the lied to. And the more power misinformation has in our world, which is like kind of all the power in the world right now. And that's the most scary thing, really. They hear things like late term abortion and they think it's some whimsical thing that, you know, a woman who's pregnant wants to like terminate a large fetus, or even, you know, Trump was pushing post-born babies, you know, like none of that happens. And now hundreds of thousands of women are being forced to give birth to dead fetuses or babies that will have horrible, painful, struggling moments of life before they die because they have Potter syndrome, or, you know, but because of the law now. So it's very, very dark, and the misinformation is incredibly strong. I understand what it is to believe something with your whole heart so much you want everyone to believe it. But if what you believe is righteous, you should be convincing other people using just only what is the truth.
Facts.
And fetuses are not poster size. They're only teeny tiny, you know.
No, I love that joke. I think that's...
Yeah, I say if they were poster size, I'd go, yeah, that's alive. You know, if they were poster size, these people would probably hunt them. But of course...
I should mention, for people listening to this, worried that maybe you've changed and you're only serious in this special, I feel like we should note that the show does open with an orgy joke.
Yeah, it's like a joke book style joke. You know, that's fun. So I go, what did the Jewish mother say to her porn star daughter after watching her in a gangbang? You were the best one. And then I have some tags, which are, my Sharon had all holes filled. You know, Jewish mothers are so proud.
But ultimately, that joke is about supportive parents.
It is. Hey!
Speaking of which, when you were coming of age in the 1970s in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Yeah. I mean, like this, I was an infant in the 70s. Let's not like act like I was like in high school coming of age.
When you were poster size infant.
Yes.
In the 1970s. Coming of age in the 1980s. Your parents are split up by then.
Mm-hmm.
You're living with your mother.
Mm-hmm.
You described her as a real life Diane Chambers.
Yes.
Who also struggled with depression.
Yeah.
When you were 12 years old, starting to fall in love with comedy, and you were on that school camping trip.
Oh my God.
Hiking up Mount Cardigan.
It was so weird to hear.
Did a similar wave of depression wash over you at that age?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it really became like a weird foreshadowing in a fucked up way where, so I was my student president of this eighth grade camping trip that everyone in eighth grade at this, my school would go on 4 days, Mount Cardigan. And I was terrified of going, a chronic bedwetter. I had to hide Pampers, large sized Pampers in my sleeping bag. I cried the whole time. And like, you know, teachers asked why. I like blamed it on like, I'm worried about my mom. I'm more, you know, whatever. Like just instead of like, I'm just so homesick and I am scared I'm going to pee in my sleeping bag. And it was a miserable, humiliating trip. I mean, nobody's fault. Everyone was, you know, the teachers were wonderful and everyone was nice. It wasn't, there wasn't a bully involved or anything anyone said, but it was miserable. And I was mad at myself and embarrassed by my behavior. And we finally reach home. And my mom, who never picked me up from things, it was always my stepdad or someone else. My mom was kind of in bed a lot of the time, and she was a photographer, you know. And I was just so humiliated. I got off the bus, and there she was. And she was just snap, 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 snap. And I just want to get in the car and go home. I'm so humiliated. And in that moment, depression gripped me and it lasted for the next 3 years.
But that teenage you, like feeling that depression for the first time, you said once that your dad would come up with all kinds of schemes to fix me. What did those look like as a teenager?
I went to a psychiatrist and I was 13, very small for my age. And he said, I'm going to give you a prescription for Xanax. And whenever you... And that wasn't a thing back then. This was very new. And he said, whenever you feel low, you just take one. And then I went to my second appointment and he had hung himself. He didn't do it while I was in the session, but I remember.
Did he have braces?
He had braces on his teeth. Yeah. And I remember thinking, because I was in the waiting room and I remember I read an entire People magazine. And I had never done that before. I got to the last page. I went, wow, I read a whole People magazine. And then I thought, wait a minute, it must be really late, you know? And it was this Victorian house that this psychiatrist shared with a hypnotist who I had gone to for bedwetting, you know, months earlier. Dr. Grimm was his name.
Oof.
But I read that whole People magazine. And then I look up and I see Dr. Grimm from upstairs with red eyes, sobbing with no bedside manner to this tiny little 13-year-old girl. And he said, Dr. Riley hung himself. I mean, even then I was just like, that can't be the way to handle this, right? And then I just had to wait until one of my parents picked me up. You know, there weren't cell phones or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because when I wrote the book, I talked to my parents and I said, I don't remember talking about it ever. After that, I don't remember like going home and you sitting me down. I don't. And I remember my dad going like, yeah, I don't either. I think we just like didn't talk about it. It was just so crazy.
So that's what I want to ask you about. Like you as a teenager, how the hell you grappled with all of that at that age? Like, how did you make sense of, okay, I guess I go back to school now.
Well, I didn't. I stayed home from school for about 3 months, and I lived with my mom, and she just couldn't make me. She didn't have the strength.
So after you have a few like pretty ineffective therapists, was there another therapist after that?
Well, the next psychiatrist I went to, who was like a registered nurse whose husband was a doctor and he wrote the prescriptions. I mean, like she really should be in jail, but she's probably dead of old age by now. I don't remember her name at all. I don't remember much about it other than she just kept upping it and upping it and upping it. And I was a 13-year-old taking 16 Xanax a day. I mean, I feel like I'm lying saying this. 4 Xanax, 4 times a day. A 13-year-old, and again, teeny tiny for my age. I look like I was 9. And I remember I kept all the empty bottles in a shoebox because I just thought, this is going to kill me. And I just like need something for like detectives to find. But like my, you know, you didn't question doctors. My parents didn't question doctors. Nobody did back then. And then eventually my mother found a psychiatrist, but he, thank God, got me off it and got me off really slowly. And I just remember sitting with my mom in his office and telling him what I was on. And he couldn't believe it. And it was kind of like this catch-all drug at the time where he said, this is a big deal. He said, my brother was put on Xanax for acne, which I don't think, I guess that must have been a thing way back when they were finding all these uses for it, and stopped cold turkey and died. I was on 16 a day. So he's like, nailed into me, like, this is, you can't just stop. You're going to take half of a pill less a week. And it took, you know, 6 months or something. And I just remember being at the Bubbla, aka water fountain, and taking that last half and being myself again.
Once the clouds have kind of parted and you start to feel a little bit like yourself again, I'm trying to understand you as a teenager. Like every night, you'd look up at the ceiling and the words would read.
Still there, by the way.
I love Steve Martin.
Yeah.
When you're not looking at the ceiling, you would stay up late and watch late night television.
Yes.
You love David Letterman, but it was an episode on the Johnny Carson show that really changed something for you. What was that?
I had this little TV in my room and my mom came upstairs and she goes, ooh, ooh, ooh. And she put on Johnny Carson and she said, this guest is, she was Miss New Hampshire. Her name was Jane Badler. And she was, you know, this actress, beautiful actress on Johnny Carson. And Martin Mull was the first guest. And she says, so cavalier, like it's no big deal, that she was a bedwetter, you know, growing up. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was so sure that this would be the biggest secret of my life, you know, that I was a bedwetter. I thought, oh, it'll be my greatest shame. I'll die if anyone finds out. And here she is making a joke of it in front of the whole world, you know, to me, the whole world, but I guess America. And it blew my mind.
Well, so I'm fascinated. Like you have this bedwetting problem till you're about 15, 16 years old.
Yeah.
Did that in some way, like embolden you to perform on stage? Because at that point were you like, well, I already can work past that. Like what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah, I think this is like the common thread with comedians, because like for me, it was like bedwetting or like being Jewish, being very hairy in a very blonde world. All these components made me funny because that's the survival skill of the oddball, you know, of the, I would say 100% of comedians are become comedians as one of the survival skills of childhood, you know.
So when you're 17 at that Mexican restaurant called La Cantina.
Yeah.
It's in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
You go up there and perform this rendition of Memories by Barbara Streisand.
Yeah.
I think it was called Mammaries.
Very, very clever. It was about being flat-chested because I was.
When you look back on that, like, young teenage Sarah getting out there, did you feel any fear?
No, because, you know, I was like, I've peed at friends' houses at sleepover parties where everyone, you know, like, this is, humiliation is like, this is nothing. You know, I know real humiliation. What am I going to not make people laugh? That's going to kill me? No way. Like, who cares? And I opened at La Cantina for the band that was playing and I bombed epically.
We actually have a clip from that night.
I wish we did. Oh, God.
Maybe for the first time in the history of human civilization, someone was emboldened by bedwetting so much so that they move to New York City, enroll at NYU, and spend their first year basically on the corner, passing out flyers to comedy clubs so that you could get 4 or 5 minutes on stage.
Without having to like bring people.
Right.
Together.
So when you do that at 18, 19 years old, and you're in New York, do you remember that phone call you had with your father telling him that you weren't sure about going back to school?
Well, my call to my dad was that I wanted to take a year off and just do stand-up, and he supported it completely.
Were you nervous about telling him that?
Not, I guess a little bit, but he was totally down with it. Like, he was like, I think that's a good idea. And then when I went back, I was a drama major, and I loved it, but I just felt like if I'm going to be at this expensive school, I can take acting classes outside of school. I want to, like, be a comic. I want to be an actor. I need information, you know? My just regular scholastic classes that I took were really interesting, and I liked that more. So I transferred to the arts and sciences school, but before I started, my dad called me and said, if you drop out of school, I'll pay your next 3 years' rent, like as if it's your sophomore, junior, senior year, and utilities, you know, so it was like $350 rent, you know.
You know, years later, in an interview in The Guardian, your dad said, my feeling was, you throw the bird up into the air, and if it falls down, you dust it off and throw it back up. And it all seemed fine to me. Sarah just seemed ready.
Oh my God. First of all, very impressed by this level of holy shit preparedness. But also, I don't remember that. That's so interesting. Like, that's kind of a smarty, interesting, thoughtful answer.
You surprised that it came from him?
Yes. I think I get a little bit of this from him there. He's like hidden smart. Like, I'm really dumb about a lot of things, but I'm like heart smart, kind of. He's heart smart, but like, he did all my money. Like, he like managed my money, like all for the first like decade of doing stand up. And then one day he asked me what K meant, and I horrifiedly went, 1,000. And I was just like, oh God, I think I need to hire a professional. And that was a scary conversation, but we just laughed, you know, because I go, Dad, you're only getting older. Like, what am I going to do? You're going to die, and then I won't have somebody managing my money. I'm just going to do it now and have someone else, you know. But
I mean, we started this conversation talking about your dad and then supportive parents.
Yeah.
And through the years, he really seemed like someone who full-heartedly believed in you.
Totally believed in me. It's not the typical comedian story. Like, all of my parents, like, were completely... But, you know, he paid for my rent those 3 years as if it were a sophomore, junior, senior year. And then I was hired on Saturday Night Live. I've always supported myself since then. So, you know, worked out.
So from 93 to 94, you work on SNL. Right at the end of 94... you're fired, something like
yeah.
that? Yeah. Coincides right when I was born. And
yeah. They said
are they
it
related?
Was, yeah, it was the birth of Sam Fragoso.
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 It's Mexican.
Is it?
Yeah.
Are you Mexican?
I'm 50%.
That's so cool.
I know. People always think
assumed
it's Italian.
Assumed Italian.
I know. 93 to 94, you work on SNL.
Yeah.
Then you get fired. Then I'm born. Completely unrelated.
Right.
You move to Los Angeles and start performing in LA, mm-hmm. start performing here in 95. At that age, where you, like any young artist, are failing all the time.
Oh my God.
How did you define yourself in response to that failure? What did that look like?
Well, I didn't see it coming at all. I never see it coming, you know, like
being fired?
Yeah, yeah. So, with Saturday Night Live, I was like, it was like August. I was already like writing, thinking of sketches for the next season and everything. And I was just like shocked. But they had done a big cleaning of, it wasn't just me. Like, they cleaned house. Like, a bunch of us got fired. But I definitely went through a long stretch of going, am I in show business anymore? I don't know if I am. Like, I just went back to, you know, comics are lucky. Like, we have stand up. So I just like, went back to one, you know, and just kept writing jokes and doing stand-up. And I met this young woman, Tracy Katsky. She was like fucking cool and like a beanie on, smoking cigarettes. I was like, oh, she's so cool, you know. And she was just like, my roommate is moving out. If you want to move in, I have a room, you know. And I go, all right. All my stuff was already in like a cardboard wardrobe box. That was my closet. Just like taped it up, moved to LA. Didn't think about it. I think that's like a real gift to just not think about stuff right. And just do it. Like any decision you make is just going to get you wherever you're going. Like, you know, I mean, it's too scary to think of how so many things have to go right for you to be on TV or this or anything, you know, like in this business. It's just like so haphazard.
But your intuition got you here.
No, just like thoughtlessness, you know, just like, all right, you want to do this? Okay. It just, things just happen.
One of the things that happened that I think is pretty formative is that you appear on the Larry Sanders Show.
Yeah.
And on that show, of course, you met the late Gary Shandling.
Well, no, I met him earlier.
You met him earlier, right. You worked with him on the show, yes.
The way I met you, playing basketball.
That's right.
And Sundays became my greatest joy. Every Sunday, basketball at Gary's. And it was just like whatever was going on in your life, whatever was happening, we had those Sundays and they were just joy. And I was so in love with him and he became such a good friend and mentor.
You said once about him, he wanted us to learn what he had to learn the hard way. He served that to us on a silver platter. What did he want you to learn that he had to learn the hard way?
The two things that pop out to me are, one was that no one is going to say that's too much for you, that you're the only one who can go, you know what, I can't do all that. And then just comedically, in terms of stand-up, I learned so much about from him, you know, just the power of the quiet moments between the words, you know, and being comfortable in those silences to not be afraid of it. And that's something that's, you know, not just about stand-up. I mean, once I really understood it, I saw it all around me. I mean, with my dad, when we would talk on the phone all the time, and if there was a quiet moment, I think he was terrified in it because he would go, and he didn't think anything of it. I'm sure he wasn't even conscious of it. But to hear that and realize at one point, you know, like, oh, he's terrified of the quiet moments.
After the break, more from comedian Sarah Silverman.
You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handle them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase Bank, NA member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates.
Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
You're on the Larry Sanders Show in the mid to late 90s. At the turn of the century, you put out, you know, your first special, I think, in 2005.
Yeah.
The Sarah Silverman program in 2007. Now, as I said at the beginning of this, I do a lot of research for these. And there's so much I really didn't remember about that special or that show, probably because I was like 10 or 11 years old.
Right.
But I do remember some of it, and I rewatched a lot.
Wow.
I want to know what that comedy was like in that period.
Right. And that's what makes it art, right? Because you watch it now, and it's like riddled with problematic stuff.
Unbelievably.
Yeah.
Some of it is really funny.
It's totally different in the context of you and the world as
Absolutely.
It is.
Absolutely. And some of it I'm like, the Sarah I know? No.
Right. No. Not the Sarah you know.
No. And it's not. And it's not. So I am fascinated. You know, people have given you a lot of grief about the bits that probably don't play now. And you know, that is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious. Yeah, you have this quote in Rolling Stone in 2005.
Oh boy.
Where you said, "I can't believe anyone not being interested in exploring taboos. Maybe it is the thing where a Catholic school."
Oh, no.
Maybe it's the thing where a Catholic school worker needs only to see the word pussy to get off, but a sex worker needs 10 little people and a juggler. A comic needs to make jokes about the most taboo topics about race or AIDS or fucked up sex to be able to get the full belly laugh for themselves.
Yeah, okay.
Is that how you saw it back then?
I think that it was part of what I saw and part of like being influenced by comedy of that time. And it's interesting because there's a little bit of dishonesty there. And I believe in that you can be dishonest in comedy. You could say like, I mean, I think it's weird to say I have a cat if you don't have a cat. But I also like, you know, I think in my first special, I said that my Nana was had a number on her arm and she didn't. She was like born in America. But somebody's grandmother did, and that was okay for me. Like, so you find the lines or whatever. But what was dishonest about it was I said, like, and maybe it's true as well, but I go, some Christian.
You said, maybe it is a thing where a Catholic school worker needs only to see the word pussy to get off.
Right. Okay, so.
How many times are you going to make me say that?
I'm sorry. Forgive me. But I was that as a, you know, like a teenager. I a friend of my older sister's, someone who lived in her dorm, gave me a penthouse for him when I was 13. And she had moved in with my dad. So it was just like in an empty room bookshelf. And I would take it out every once in a while and just look at the word pussy to like masturbate as a teenager. That's all it took. I mean, because I couldn't even believe it. I mean, it had so much power.
Wow.
And then years later as a comedian,
It
lost its power. It was like nothing. But for some reason, I say, oh, a Catholic school worker need only to see the word. But that was me.
That was you.
Yeah, it was me, of course. I mean, all those things are so taboo. I mean, in a million years, I never thought I would talk about masturbation or wetting the bed or any of that stuff with ease and without immense shame, you know?
If that's how you saw your work then in 2005... How did it change after that?
Well, working on the Sarah Silverman program was really fun. And it was kind of born out of Jesus's magic, which like it's also problematic, you know, in lots of ways. But it was all based on me playing Sarah Silverman, a character that's not me, but named Sarah Silverman. And that character was this ignorant person who's wildly arrogant. And to, those two things together were really funny and kind of magical to me.
An unreliable narrator.
Yeah. And so she did racist things, thinking that she was being inclusive. She did, you know, I mean, it really is like, in a way, a lot of it was like the track of a liberal who is saying, oh, it was only 12 years ago. Well, 12 years ago is like another time. And I got more political in my comedy. I got, you know, I was more active. I made a video for Obama to get young Jews to visit their grandparents in Florida and threaten not to visit if they don't vote for Obama. You know, so I was doing all this stuff, but I was also, you know, in this show where I was playing a character. And of course, looking back on it, the right can use a lot of memes and a lot of things I said in that special, in that show, and take the quote and put it with a picture of me speaking at the Democratic National Convention. And I got death threats because it was like taking me from Jesus's magic, saying like, I'm glad the Jews killed Jesus. I'd do it again. Like a complete character moment and wildly like, very, very clear if you're in that audience. I'm taking transcript from that and putting it to a picture of me speaking at the Democratic National Convention. You know, I got a lot of death threats from that. I got, there's a preacher saying killing me would be God's will. And he got really like very visual about it, like knocking my teeth out. And that's what really gave me the chills, like that element.
So did the hate that came from that period, did that make you rethink what you wanted to do and how you wanted to do it?
Yeah. I mean, well, a lot of it I talked about in my Hulu show. And and I brought things up that hadn't ever been brought up about, you know, like when I wore blackface on this or something. And it wasn't like I brought it up because it was about to come out or something. Like I always try to use myself in ways that are unseemly, you know. And that episode when I'm in blackface, you know, like most of the people in that episode are black, you know, there was like you can't, like, I talk about it on the Hulu show and I'm very clear about it. And I know that I can't erase it from existence, but somehow somebody did. You cannot see that episode. And I guess that's a good thing. But there's a still photo of me and that just has no context. It just looks like I put that on and thought it was funny, you know? There was context in the episode and you're not allowed to say that, but there was. I'm not saying it's okay or that I do it now or that I don't very much wish I never did it, but there was.
I think what I'm getting at is the character you were playing, it was this unreliable narrator.
Right.
The kind that Stephen Colbert made a career out of on the Colbert Report. And I do find it interesting that his show ended and in many ways your comedy kind of shifted right around the time Trump started running for president.
Yeah.
It's in 2015.
Well, that, you know, it's funny because I had so much fun playing an ignorant arrogant. But when the president became Donald Trump, who is exactly that pathology, he is an absolutely ignorant arrogant. It wasn't so fun anymore.
You mentioned I Love You, America.
Yeah.
The show came out in 2017, the year Trump starts his, I guess we can call it presidency. And it seemed like it was a program deeply inspired by your love of Mr. Rogers.
Yes.
And I guess I'm wondering, the thing you were after in that show, compassion, kindness, talking to people across the aisle.
Face to face with people and, you know, like it was like we aren't that different.
Do you still believe that?
I do. I mean, listen, I met with almost exclusively like Trump supporters and stuff and went to their house and put myself in a position where they were hosting me. They were taking care of me. I was like the odd man out, you know? And every single one of those homes I left, I felt loved by them and I loved them. Even when they have things that are annoying or that I don't agree with, you can see in their eyes where it's coming from or what it has to do with or where, you know, that show, like we did two seasons, although they were called season one and season one B. But I do feel like a good amount of people saw it for such a niche show. I mean, that's just, you know, like every time a show I do is canceled or a pilot's not picked up, I always feel like, you know, they blew it. Why they didn't get it? How could they? You know, it's like every reason why they were wrong. And it's just like, it's their channel. It's their, they could do what they want. You know, it's like, and I always get over it. And then I can't imagine doing it now. Like, you know, I don't know.
Do you think you can't imagine doing it now? Because in some ways, you're doing it on the podcast?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because I remember like my agents going like, well, right before the pandemic, the special came out of a deal that was a pilot deal I did at HBO. I did a pilot right before the pandemic and then they didn't pick it up. And I was like, they blew it. What were they? You know, like that's my reaction is like, wow, they made such a mistake, you know. But like, I have no desire to do it now because I get that itch satiated totally on my podcast where I can say anything I want.
So the podcast itself, it features a lot of voicemails.
Yeah, it's all voice. I'll usually say something at the beginning or I'll talk about something that's on my mind. Sometimes we go right into voicemails, but the trajectory of the show is always just the voicemails.
People asking for advice for the most part.
Yeah. You know, I'm loose on it. I'm silly, I suppose, at times, and I talk about like embarrassing things or, but yeah, I'm not really in charge of the direction it goes, you know, which I like.
But I think that's kind of because your aim is to really hear the person out, the stranger that's called in. And I was thinking, because I was listening to it this morning, and I thought, oh, it's strange, but the thing you're doing is connecting with people. And the way you're connecting with them really reminds me of how you've always described your father, which is someone who moved through the world like open-hearted and open-minded, who would go to Starbucks really early and just like talk to these women and befriend them.
It was so hard to let people know about his funeral because he had so many like islands of friends. He had like his girlfriends from Starbucks, you know, that he just knows them from Starbucks. Or like, I mean, we were at Mendocino Farms and he loved being old because it gave him a whole new like level of connection with people because he got away. You can get away with so much. You know, people find it charming. Or so we were at Mendocino Farms and these two like huge muscle head guys are leaving and they stop at our table and put their fists in my dad's face and go like, you know, like see you around. But they had like, they did some tough guy like move with him and they walk out and I was like, what was that? And he's laughing and he goes, oh, I was refilling my Coke and I saw them and they were all muscly. So I went over and I go, you know what? I feel like kicking some ass. And he like put his fists up to them, you know, like he was threatening them. And, you know, they, of course, they thought it was adorable and stopped by the table all the way up. But there's always like there's always someone he's already connected with, you know, and it was so sweet. And I like that, too. I'm a people person, you know.
Does that make sense? Like, do you feel in some ways this podcast of yours is, you know, you're not like an octogenarian, but it is a license to connect with people in a way that is human. I guess I'm trying to say, do you feel like you're doing what your dad always did and
yes.
showed you?
Yes. He loved connecting with people. Yeah. He was like a real people person guy. You know, everyone loved him. I mean, he was like the go-to friend to make a speech or a toast at the whatever, you know. But yeah, that desire for connection, you know, to be brutally honest, maybe the desire to be loved by a stranger, you know, which is, of course, like the plight of comedians, you know. But yeah, to connect with someone you don't, you know, in a grocery line or, you know, I don't know.
My last, I guess, thing for you, or my last question. We started this conversation talking about, you know, your dad, and it's been, what, a month? Not even a month. Three weeks?
20 days?
And it dawned on me that this new project of yours, this podcast, it uses voicemails in such a great way. And there was really no one who mastered the art of the voicemail better than your father.
Oh my God, I wish I still had those messages.
Well, I have a couple of them that were in your book. I thought, as we leave, since this is on Father's Day,
yes,
I wanted to read one of them in his voice.
I would love to. Let's see, this is from 14 years ago. Hey, baby, guess who? It's your daddy. Happy Shabbos. I say that because your friend, Jeffrey Ross, is in Israel, and I've been spending time with your nieces. I took Shishi, that's my niece, Ashira, to Chuck E. Cheese twice. She is so fucking cute. Give me a call when you get a chance. I leave in a couple of hours, but I'll be in my car for an hour or two. Know where I'm going? I'm going to my 50th fucking reunion of UNH. It took, God, I remember this message. It took 50 fucking years to get here. Going through it, it was all those days with you and Lara and Jodine and Susie and aggravation and business and blah, blah, blah. And you look back on it, it seemed like it took 20 minutes. Whole goddamn thing. It's amazing. Took so long to get here just to look back so quickly. Wow. So watch out, because you're only going one way, and that's older. And once you can, yeah, this is, it's so true. And once you can no longer do something, it's forever. I've been pretty goddamn lucky so far. I love you. That's my homily for, that's my homily for the day. I love you. Give me a call if you get a chance, like if you're walking your dog or something boring like that. And I'll talk to you later. Mwah. Shut off phone. No, that was him. I'd hear him. Wow, isn't that funny? Like, now he's dead and it like has this beautiful meaning. And it is all so true. I mean, and it's really helped me. Stuff like that. And also something that my sister said when I was dreading going to camp, which was every year because I just pissed myself every single night and it was a nightmare. But she said, you know what? You're going to go through it and it's all going to be a memory. And that's that. It's like so long, life. But then when you look back on it, it's a blip. So every shitty thing you have to do that you don't want to do, you can just like exist through it. It probably won't even be as bad as you think. And when it's over, it's just like another blip. But one of those messages I know was, and I know by heart, he goes, I know you're a big Hollywood hotshot now, but if you get a chance in your busy schedule, maybe you could give the guy a call back who gave you life. I used to wipe the shit out from your tuchus. Maybe you could find a minute for me.
It was fucking disgusting. All right.
Oh, is that what he says at the end? Oh my God, here it is. I remember when you were a tiny baby, I had to lift those tiny legs and wipe the shit out of your tuchus. It was fucking disgusting. All right, if you get a chance, I know you're busy. Give a call back to the guy who gave you life. Love you, bye. Yeah.
That line, it took so long to get here, just to look back so quickly.
Yeah, my God. It's deep.
We've gone through... shit, 52 years of time.
Yeah.
I don't know how you hold that line now that he's been gone, fuck, only 20 days. But that's just, I don't know, there's so much. When I read that in your book, I lost it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, look at that. Like, now that has a whole new meaning, you know? It's interesting. He was awesome. Mm. But this is what is.
If we both didn't love Gary Shandling, we would be uncomfortable with this moment. But
that's right. For the people at home, Sam really looks like he might cry, and I am dead inside completely.
For people at home, I was going to cry, and then I realized Sarah doesn't do well with tears, so I just...
You know, this is an excellent ending, and you'll end it here. But talking about connection and getting that from my dad, I mean, he loved sports because of that. He loved playing tennis or whatever. And like, that was basketball for me. I say was, because I don't know if I don't know if I'll be back. Maybe I'll give it a try. But
what
I just,
can we do to pull you out of retirement?
You know what? It was my joy playing basketball. It's so wonderful, like just connecting with people and meeting friends through all sorts of different things. And but, you know, it doesn't age well, basketball. But boy, I love it so much. And I was really like, I would quit like a half hour early and stretch. Mm-hmm. And so maybe I'll go back. I kind of thought to myself, well, maybe I'll just play half court games. But I really miss the Sunday game.
Well, we've talked about a lot of things.
Yeah.
That haven't aged well.
It's true. That's true. This is actually perfect.
But I'm hoping that this podcast does.
Thank you. Me too.
I think it will. And in the spirit of your show and for this Father's Day episode, we are winding down.
Oh, Dad.
And I thank you so much for coming on, for sharing as much as you have, you know, for putting that sign up at that party. That's a no solicitation.
No podcast solicitations.
Sarah Silverman, a joy.
Thank you. You Mexican. Oh, no! He's half Mexican.
Please end the tape there. Can we end it
Or like a little before.
Oh, my. Bye, Sarah. And that's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave us a review on Spotify, Apple, wherever you do your listening. If you've already done that or just want to go above and beyond, sharing the show with a friend or posting on social media is still the best way for new listeners to find the program. You can tag us at TalkEasyPod on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, pretty much all of them. And this week, I want to thank our guest, Sarah Silverman, for coming on the program. Her new special, Someone You Love, is now available to stream on Max. If you'd like to learn more about her and her work, visit our show notes at talkeasypod.com. If this is your first time listening, or if you've been here for a minute, I'd recommend our talks with Bob Odenkirk, Abby Jacobson, Quinton Brunson, John Early, Nick Kroll, Meg Stalter, Norman Lear, and the great Carol Burnett. To hear those and more podcasts from Pushkin Industries, listen on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. If you want to purchase one of our mugs, they come in cream or navy, or our vinyl record with Fran Lebowitz, you can do so at talkeasypod.com/shop. That's talkeasypod.com/shop. As always, Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Our research and production assistant is Paulina Suarez. Today's episode was edited by CJ Mitchell, special assistance from Caitlin Dryden, and mixed by Andrew Vastola. Our assistant editor is Clarice Guevara. Our music is by Dylan Peck. Illustrations by Krisha Shenoy. Photographs today by Julius Chu. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gabrizak, Ian Jones, and Ethan Seneca. Special thanks to Kaylin Ung. I also want to thank our team at Pushkin Industries, Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, David Glover, Heather Fain, Eric Sandler, Jordan McMillan, Isabella Navarez, Tara Machado, Maya Koenig, Jason Gambrell, Justine Lang, Malcolm Gladwell, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next week with a new episode. Until then, happy Father's Day to you and yours. Stay safe, and so long.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.